So tonight's topic I called Finding a Teacher. And Jack Kornfield, who is certainly a wonderful teacher and has trained many, many teachers, says, "When I am asked how someone can find a teacher, the most honest thing I can say is that this is a mysterious process." So I'm not guaranteeing anything tonight. We're just going to explore it a little bit, and hopefully it will be a little bit of help for you. As Barbara alluded to when doing the announcements, the initial training in Asia for lay people like ourselves is generosity, ethical behavior, and then eventually cultivating the mind through meditation. And it seems like every time I'm up here, I ask the same question: why are we practicing? And if what we're practicing for is a little bit of relief from our daily stress, that's fine. You probably don't need a senior teacher for that objective. And let me be clear tonight, what I'm talking about is taking on a senior teacher, someone that has been authorized to actually act as a teacher in this tradition. So there's several levels of training available in the Theravada tradition, the Insight tradition. Myself and Jeff Harden, whom we were speaking about earlier, Diane Wild, Sandra Sigrist, Dave Sanders, all of us are trained by Dennis in a program called a Practice Development and Leadership Program. And so that's one level. We were trained to be mentors, spiritual friends with all of you in this community. Then Dennis himself and a lot of other people in this area were trained in the Community Dharma Leader Program at Spirit Rock. So I would include Tony Bernhard, Maeve Hassett, and Mary Ellen Fine at Mountain Stream, Christy Tews and Kathy Schwerin over at Dharma Zephyr in Northern Nevada. They're trained in that, what's called the CDL program. And then Jeff and Diane subsequently went through that training themselves. I applied for it and was not accepted. Another story. But anyway, that's another level of training that's available. In this tradition, the highest level of training that's available is the two flagship Insight Meditation Centers in this country. One in Western Massachusetts called Insight Meditation Society, and then the one that came subsequent to that, Spirit Rock Meditation Center, which we're very fortunate to have just over here in Marin County, are the two big Insight Meditation Centers, and they have a joint teacher training program. So it's 3 to 4 years, and it trains people to be retreat teachers. That's the purpose of that, is so that they're able to lead residential retreats. Okay? So those are the levels of teacher training that are available. Given the length of time of the training and so forth, these senior teachers, what we'll call senior teachers, people that have been gone through that training, are quite familiar with many of the more, let's just say, exotic states that become available to us with longer practice. And so that's why they need that extra training for retreat training. And so they're particularly adept at working with some of the mind states and things that appear after long periods of practice. So if you're thinking about getting a teacher, the first thought would be, okay, which level would be appropriate for your current level of practice within that spectrum? And the ultimate goal of this practice being liberation, Joseph in his book, Joseph Goldstein, and the citation for the book is on the handout. It's Insight Meditation, the Practice of Freedom. And he has a little two-page essay called The Role of a Teacher. He says that there are two obstacles on the way to liberation, on the path. One is suffering and the other one is happiness. So suffering's obvious, right? I mean, it can be really helpful to have someone that's kind of been there before that can help you get through the rough patch. But happiness is a temptation on the path. This practice brings many side benefits. You know, it brings peace, it brings calmness, it can alleviate some of the drama that we were experiencing earlier this evening. One of us will have to go over there and invite him to join us someday. In all sincerity, we should. There are side benefits, right, on the way to liberation. But on that path, there are many very, what Steve calls, scenic turnouts. Scenic turnouts on the path to liberation. These are places where the peace and the joy and the bodily suffusion with happiness are so pleasant that we don't want to move on. We don't want to take on the deeper material that's actually preparing us for. So we need a teacher that's able to say, that's really great, move on. That's not the end of the practice. Keep on going. And then there are stages that are really rough. They're often called the rolling up the mat stage, when they're so challenging to our view of who we are and what reality is that we just want to roll up the mat and go home and quit our practice. And that's another time that we really need a very senior teacher. So how would you find that? Well, I decided at some point in my practice that I wanted to have a teacher. So I went to a teacher who shall remain unnamed, who's on the Spirit Rock Teacher Council, and I asked her if she would be my teacher, and without hesitation she said, no, I already have plenty of students. So, you know, in this tradition there's no thought that because you ask somebody they have to do it, or, you know, also in this tradition, to be a senior teacher like Steve Armstrong and the people that he and Kamala are training right now, Kamala Masters is another senior teacher, they're actually training the next generation of teachers right now. And to be that kind of a teacher, you need to be invited. You don't just sign up for that training, okay? You need to be invited. Steve was invited after 5 years as a monk in Asia with Upandita. So he did not actually go through the formal training. He did his training over in Asia and then came back, disrobed as a monk, and was asked to teach. That's another path. After some years and seeing Steve at the One Days here and going on a couple of residential retreats with him, I decided to ask him to be my teacher. So I said, Steve, will you be my teacher? And he said, what does that mean? In his way. So I think the purpose of this question, from my point of view at the time, was so that I could articulate what it actually was I was looking for. Subsequent to that, Dennis reminded me that Steve is a trainer of senior teachers, and so if I had any thought that I was going to ask him to be my teacher and become a senior teacher, that wasn't going to happen. But, you know, we very clearly established that what I was looking for, it was right when I was taking on my role as a mentor here, so I was looking for some guidance in my own practice. I was looking for some guidance in that role as a mentor, and I was also looking for some guidance because I took on the board role, and Steve has tons of organizational experience with sanghas around the country and around the world. So actually, whenever we meet, he finds time to talk to me about those three roles. It's really wonderful, and it's fantastic support. So in this tradition, the teacher is a Kalyanamitta. It's a spiritual friend. So I think I have a quote here from Joseph that says, in the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, the teacher is considered a Kalyanamitta, a spiritual friend. And then below that quote, I have a quotation from a sutta that was given to Digajanu that's in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, about what is meant by admirable friendship. There is the case where a lay person in whatever town or village he may dwell spends time with householders or householders' sons or daughters, young or old, who are advanced in virtue. He or she talks with them, engages them in discussions. She or he emulates consummate conviction in those who are consummate in conviction. consummate virtue in those who are consummate in virtue, consummate generosity in those who are consummate in generosity, and consummate discernment in those who are consummate in discernment. This is called admirable friendship. So you notice in that we might need to go to different teachers for different things, and we might need to go to different spiritual friends for different things. Some people might be really great in virtue. Other people might be better in their conviction, their faith, right? And other people might be better in discernment, which is another word for wisdom. So there is no idea in this tradition that you need to sign up with one teacher and stick with them for life. You're encouraged to actually try learning from different sources. Now, ultimately, the source is within, right? It's within each of us. That's the ultimate source for all of this. And teachers in various Buddhist traditions range from this idea of the Kalyanamitta, the spiritual friend, all the way to that of a guru, in which we completely give over our guidance, if you think of it that way, to this teacher. There's even a concept in Tibetan practice that the guru is perfect, no matter what they say or do, even if it seems counterintuitive. Now, the original purpose of that was that some of us need a little bit of shaking up to actually progress on the path. And so some of these counterintuitive teachings, some of the koans that are used in Zen teaching are specifically used to kind of break through that intellectual defensiveness, that shell, that kind of tightly held view of self. The problem with that is that has led to some abuses. That giving over a personal power to the guru or to any greatly venerated teacher has led to some abuses of power. And the way Joseph puts it in Insight Meditation, the Practice of Freedom, is that we are confusing authority with power. He says, acknowledging someone's understanding in a particular area, see again how he's pointing out that we can learn, everyone in here is a teacher, as Diana said many times, we can learn different aspects of many different things from everybody in this room. When we take on a senior teacher, we should understand that acknowledging someone's understanding in a particular area should not be confused with conferring power. We can welcome guidance, instruction, and inspiration without abandoning our own inner moral sense. So particularly in this tradition, we really rely on our own common sense. If something doesn't feel comfortable with the teacher in this tradition, you're encouraged to act on that. Okay? So I just want to make that really clear, that there have been a number of scandals and abuses over the decades here in the West. I can't speak to what's happened in Asia. There was an entire issue of the Buddha Dharma magazine, I have the reference on the handout, called Confronting Abuse of Power. And if you happen to read this or the subsequent issue, there were a number of letters that said, I'm so glad that somebody spoke out about this. Because often it's sort of kept below the radar. There's a lot of shame associated with the kind of abuses that might happen. Whether they're physical, financial, you know, handing over all your money, we've heard about some of those stories, sexual or psychological. It can be abuse on any level, and we need to acknowledge and deal with that. One of the primary points they make in here is that abuse does not happen, in Buddhist circles, does not happen only to one individual. That if you have experienced some sort of abuse of power, that's happening to the whole community. Even if you were the only one that was targeted, you're a member of the community, and so any abuse of power that occurred to you, you should understand that that's not your shameful secret to hold on your own, because whether it comes public or not, it's affecting the entire community. And, you know, even if you were at that time the only person, then there's a pattern there, and that could happen to someone else in the future. And your speaking out could save someone else the suffering, both the abuser and the abused, right? The suffering of having another incident happen. So I would really encourage any of you that experience anything that feels kind of off to you in terms of relating to any of us, whether that's you know, any of us in our mentor role or any visiting teacher that we bring in. We have had incidents where actually Dennis has intervened on behalf of another community when a visiting teacher had something come up that was really uncomfortable for someone. So we just need to be aware that if something like that occurs, don't keep it to yourself. Bring it to the board. Bring it to someone else you trust within the community, and understand that that's a community experience, regardless of whether it happened one-on-one in private or whatever. Okay? So please keep that in mind. So as we're looking for a teacher within this whole range of styles, the Buddha recommended certain qualities in a teacher. And these are listed in Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Fives. So the way that the numerical discourses are organized in the Anguttara Nikaya is that there are a bunch of lists. You've heard about the Buddhist lists. So a bunch of lists, and they're arranged by numbers. So those are the ones, the twos, the threes, the fours, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, etc. So these are in the fives, so that means there'll be five qualities that he recommends. I've included two translations here because I think both of them contain a bit of the truth about these qualities that we might want to look for in a teacher. So the first translation is from Access to Insight, which is the online resource that's available. Many of those translations are by Tanasaro Bhikkhu, who's a German monk living in America, and his name is Jeffrey de Graaf, his given name, his born name. And so people often call him Tan Jeff. When you hear people talk about Tan Jeff, it's Tanasaro Bhikkhu Jeffrey de Graaf. So I'll just say Tan Jeff for short. Tanasaro Bhikkhu has too many syllables for me right now. The second translation is from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's an American monk who lives on the East Coast and who has done many of the books that are published by Wisdom Publications. Are also available online as e-books, and the Anguttara Nikaya is about that thick. So it's just a major work. He just did that in 2012. So he starts off by saying, it isn't easy to teach the Dhamma to others, Ananda. It's not easy. And he recommends that the Dhamma should be taught to others only when five qualities are established within the person teaching. Or Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is, one who teaches the Dhamma to others should first set up five qualities internally. Okay? So this first one, and these are on your handout, the first one is the Dhamma should be taught with the thought, I will speak step by step. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is, I will give a progressive talk. The way that I have heard that expressed as well is in terms of the gradual training. You've heard of the gradual training? And the gradual training means that in this practice, we believe that there's a concept of ripeness. In fact, this applies to finding a teacher as well. There's a time when we just feel in our practice that we're ripe to be open to the teachings of another person. Now, that phrase you may have heard, when the student is ready, the teacher will come, that's a fake Buddha quote. You can actually find that on fakebuddhaquotes.com. It's a site I really recommend because it goes beyond just saying, the Buddha didn't really say that. The person that owns this website, fakebuddhaquotes.com, does this extensive study about where the quote actually may have come from and why people thought it was a Buddhist quote. In fact, people brought this quote to him, and he says, "I have no idea. I'd never thought that was a Buddhist quote." You know? And so he claims it comes from Theosophy, which I'm not going to try to get into, but it's an early 20th century kind of New Agey religion, philosophical system. So that quote has nothing to do with Buddhism. But there is this concept of ripeness. I remember telling Dennis when I was training with him, "Dennis, by the time I've been practicing as long as you have, I'll be dead." And he said, "Well, you know, there's this idea of ripeness, that when you were ready to come to the teachings, you did. And if you'd come before that, you might not have been ready to hear them in the way that you've heard them." So just keep that in mind. If you don't have a teacher now, don't worry about it. You may not need one, you may never need one, but when you're really called, that's the time to go to some of these qualities and review them. If you've already got a teacher, go back and review these. If the teacher doesn't meet these, think about that, okay? So the first one is the gradual training. Is this someone that meets you where you are? You know, the Buddha had this great quality of being able to talk to individuals and know exactly where they were. So if he was talking to a Brahmin, he would use Brahmin language. If he was talking to an average lay householder, he'd use average lay householder language. If he was talking to brand new monks, like when he talked to Rahula, his son, when he was 7 years old, he used very simple language. You know, he talked about, "Oh, if I take this bowl and I empty it out, that's how empty it would be." You know, how empty the practice would be for someone that tells a lie is what he was doing. Very simple similes. When he talked to the more advanced monks, he used more advanced language. So meeting everyone where they are. So to me, that's what the gradual training is. Tan Jeff, in his notes on speaking step by step, talks about, I think this is the one where he talks about understanding karma, step by step in understanding karma. But Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't have any of that implication. He just talks about a progressive talk, something that rolls out naturally, that doesn't sort of jump beyond where you are with your practice. Okay? And there are plenty of suttas where somebody's given one kind of instruction and it's not working for them, and the Buddha tells them, "Oh, try this, try a different practice." So your teacher should be able to meet you where you are and give you a gradual training, something that progresses as you progress. The second one, Tan Jeff's translation is, "I will speak explaining the sequence," and then he adds in brackets, which means those are his words, not a literal translation, "of cause and effect." So dependent origination, right? One of the really deep teachings, one of the unique things that the Buddha taught. So Tan Jeff interprets this thing about explaining the sequence as being teaching dependent origination, teaching how and why we suffer, basically, right? That's what dependent origination is about. On the other hand, Bhikkhu Bodhi interprets this differently. He says, "I will give a talk that shows reasons." Okay, so we all learn in different ways. Some of us have a lot of faith, and someone can say something, we can say, "Oh, I get that, I understand that, I believe that." Others are very questioning, and skeptical doubt in this practice is considered a very skillful means. Skeptical doubt. When you don't just take something for granted, that you actually explore it, you use your investigation to look into it. So asking those kind of questions, not the doubt where you say, "Oh, I'm a bad meditator, this will never work for me," that's an unskillful kind of a doubt. That's a hindrance. But a kind of healthy skepticism where we say, "Oh, well, that sounds okay, but what about this?" You know, just the healthy asking of questions, testing things. I think that's what this one is getting at, is I will give a talk that shows reasons. This gives a person that has an inquisitive mind the reasons behind what we're teaching and doesn't just expect them to accept it on blind faith. Okay? So that's the second one. The third one, I think, is fairly obvious. I will speak out of compassion or out of sympathy. So we want a teacher that's coming from a place of loving kindness, of friendliness, who's really looking out for our best interests. You think about the formal loving kindness meditation that we do. First, we offer kindness to ourselves. And second, we offer it to a benefactor or a mentor. That would be where you would be offering it to your teacher. And the image that we're looking for of the teacher is someone that just completely accepts us as we are. Doesn't make demands beyond what we're capable of, completely accepts us how we are. So that's the quality that we're speaking about here. Someone that we feel completely safe with, and someone that accepts us as we are, and really works with us out of compassion and out of sympathy. The fourth one, really interesting. The Dhamma should be taught with the thought, I will speak not for the purpose of material reward. And the other way of looking at that is, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, having determined, I will not give a talk while intent on material gain. One should teach the Dhamma to others. Okay, this speaks directly to our Dana culture in the insight tradition. So, you know, sometimes when I'm teaching the beginning class and I see that we're offering it for $35 for 6 weeks, and I'm actually thinking about lowering that fee. And then I see these beginning meditation classes are $195. I've seen them on flyers in Berkeley and stuff. I think, you know, I wonder in this consumer culture, if someone looks at that and thinks, oh, that's the good one. That $195 one, those must be the people that know what they're talking about. You know, those people charging $35, they either don't know what they're talking about or they don't know the value of what they're teaching, you know. Well, I mean, as you know from attending SIM, there is no monetary value that can be put on these teachings. These teachings are priceless. So the idea of charging for them is just incompatible with even embarking on this path. And, you know, Barbara alluded earlier to the joy of giving. It deprives the student of the chance of doing that, of giving from their heart instead of giving, you know, suggested donation, $195. I mean, those aren't even suggested donations. Those are, you pay this fee or you're not in the class. So, you know, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, you may recall a few years back, the board decided that when the mentors first started teaching here at SIM, we didn't get any Dhamma. And that was based on Dennis's practices. I mean, for all of the years that he started and founded this Sangha, he never took any Dhamma. So we didn't either. The board at some point decided that it would get half of the Dhamma that's given on an evening to the mentors, and it would keep the other half to keep the lights on and that sort of thing. To bring in senior teachers and that sort of thing. So that is not a usual position that many of us are in, is to be given free will offerings from other people. And so I recognized right away, this is something I should go to my teacher about. So next time I saw Steve, I said, Steve, the board has decided to have the mentors get half of the Dhamma. Do you have any suggestions? You know, I've never been in this position before. And he said, watch your mind. Which is what he says to everything. But in this particular context, I thought that's really good advice. Watch the mind. Watch the mind when I receive Dhamma. Watch the mind when I don't receive Dhamma. Just watch the mind around this practice, and it's a practice of receiving Dhamma. So just as all of us are practicing in this community giving Dhamma, now a few of us have the opportunity to actually practice receiving Dhamma. And it's eye-opening to watch the mind when money's involved in this culture, right? It's really enlightening. So, you know, I don't have any overall lessons. I've only been doing this for a couple of years in terms of receiving Dhamma. I don't have any big, you know, lightning bolt insights around that. But just to know that the receiving of Dhamma is a practice in itself that merits watching the mind. And it can interfere with the teaching. If all of a sudden, you know, we're on the lecture circuit for the sole purpose of making money, you can imagine how that's going to affect the teaching, right? Because you're not going to want to teach what's hard. You're not going to want to tell somebody something they don't want to hear, right? You're going to want to make it pleasant. You want to make it entertaining. You might water down the teachings so that
you keep getting a big crowd and people show up and give you more money. I mean, that's one possible scenario. Okay? So, good advice. Don't give a talk while intent on material gain. Interesting, the translation, Bhikkhu Bodhi, looking at intention, whereas Tan Jeff just says, speaking not for the purpose of a material reward. Interesting there, the difference. One's a goal and one's an intention. Out of the same words. So let that be a lesson to you. I encourage you to look at multiple translations of some of these suttas. Even something as simple as a list of five things that are the qualities of a teacher, you can benefit from looking at more than one translation. The fifth one differs even more in the translation. Tan Jeff's translation is, the Dhamma should be taught with the thought, I will speak without disparaging myself or others. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is, I will give a talk without harming myself or others. So the notes to that in the Anguttara Nikaya, that's that thick, say disparaging means kind of putting yourself down. Or let me see, am I getting this backwards? Yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi says without harming myself or others. So in his notes, he says that harming in this case means taking yourself and puffing yourself up. So it's kind of a different translation. Tan Jeff says they both mean disparaging myself or others. But Bhikkhu Bodhi says harming means I don't build myself up and I don't put others down. So he sees it as more of a two-way thing. So both of those are good advice, right? Shouldn't be up here disparaging ourselves. I mean, to some extent, we should be providing some degree of inspiration. And, you know, that doesn't prevent us from sharing our struggles. But the advice I've been given is that we share them after we've actually worked through them. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you're a very skillful teacher, it's probably best not to be sharing your struggles when you're right in the middle of them, because that can just be confusing for folks. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. Especially, you know, at my level of practice, not being, you know, a senior practitioner like John Travis. I mean, I don't know how many of you are here the night he talked about trying to practice when he had that, you know, that sepsis that went through his whole body and knocked him out, and he was on morphine in the hospital. And people are asking him, well, you know, how did your practice get you through that? You know, how did your mind? He says, are you kidding? You know, I could not practice until I got the pain under control. And to hear someone like that, that's at that advanced 40 years of practice, is helpful, right? But for someone with less skill and experience to be up here working through their angst in public, it's probably not going to be all that helpful. So I have been counseled, you know, to share my struggles, certainly, and, you know, to speak from the edge of my practice. I mean, that's what's being encouraged. But to do that from a place of knowing what I'm talking about, speaking from experience and working through it, okay? So those are the five qualities, and then, as often happens in the suttas, he finishes up with reiterating where it started. It isn't easy, Ananda, to teach the Dhamma to others. One who teaches the Dhamma to others should first set up these five qualities internally. I found one other definition of a Dhamma teacher that was interesting to me, and it's on the top of the back page of your handout. A monk came to the Buddha, an unnamed monk came to the Buddha and said, Dhamma teacher, they say, Lord. And the Buddha replied, if, monk, anyone teaches a doctrine of disenchantment with decay and death, of dispassion leading to its cessation, that suffices for him to be called a monk who teaches the Dhamma. So the first list of five qualities was kind of an overall set of things that we really should look at in every teacher. What we're getting here is kind of a baseline, a bottom line bar of someone. So let's tease this apart a little bit. Disenchantment with decay and death.
The Buddha said that there are two kinds of suffering. The first kind of suffering is a suffering that leads into more suffering. If we're not able to handle our suffering, if we don't have the skills, it can overwhelm us, and it can just lead us into more suffering. The second kind of suffering is a suffering that motivates us to actually address the discontent, the dissatisfaction that's in our lives, and have a resolve to do something about it. So that's the suffering that moves us out of suffering. So what we're talking about here, disenchantment, is the quality of recognizing that, it's basically the first noble truth, recognizing that discontentment, dissatisfaction exists in life and resolving to do something about it. So disenchantment, it has that literal meaning. That meaning we're no longer enchanted by the illusions of things the way we used to think they are. We're now awake to the fact that we think we're going to live forever. That's an illusion. We think this body is going to be healthy forever. It's never going to get sick. That's an illusion. We think we're never going to die. That's an illusion. You know, we think we're never going to get old. That's an illusion. That waking up, breaking the enchantment, is literally disenchantment. In this practice, that's a very healthy realization. It's also one where you might need some guidance, because it can lead to some degree of difficulty. All of a sudden, the way that you thought things were, maybe they aren't that way. Maybe you aren't going to live forever. Maybe that loved one of yours that you thought would be in your life forever is not going to outlive you, you know? Maybe they're not going to be around forever either. Okay? So it can be a very stressful realization, but it's a very necessary one for this practice. So I think that's why the Buddha is recommending that coming to a teacher who understands disenchantment with decay and death. That's just another way of saying impermanence, right? Someone that understands the disenchantment around the fact that things change. Things, no matter how terrible they are right now, they're going to change. No matter how wonderful things are right now, they're going to change. And it really helps to have a teacher to guide you through that process. Dispassion is a similar concept. It's what is sometimes mistranslated as detachment. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his notes, says that the literal translation of it is dis, or not, passion, getting all worked up about things. Okay, we saw an example of that earlier tonight. Getting all worked up about things that actually in the moment wasn't a problem, right? His restaurant's not open, but he's getting all worked up about it. So the ability to not get all worked up about things that shouldn't cause us to get all worked up. It doesn't mean that we don't have a great deal of passion for our practice, or that we don't have a strong bond of love for our loved ones, or that we don't have, you know, compassion for the suffering in the world. It just means that we're not getting all worked up about things that don't deserve to not get worked up about. Dispassion. And there's just a lot packed into this phrase, dispassion leading to its cessation. So cessation is nirodha, and nirodha is just before nibbana, complete liberation of the mind, right? So what he's saying here is that the ability to develop this dispassion will lead to the cessation of suffering. Okay? And then the cessation of suffering eventually will lead to liberating insight. Is another way of thinking about it. So we're looking for someone who can help us see impermanence, help us bear with the disenchantment that might come along with that realization, and we're looking for someone who can help us cultivate dispassion that can lead to the end of suffering. Okay? Very inspiring. So I'm going to finish this section, and we'll have time for questions and answers, with another quote from Jack Kornfield's book, Path with Heart. His chapter 16 is called You Can't Do It Alone, Finding and Working with a Teacher. In fact, I was reading that book when I came to SIM, and I was stuck on that chapter. And I've talked to many other people who are reading that book when they came to some kind of spiritual practice, and I've talked to a couple of others who were stuck on that chapter. It's one of the reasons I decided to give this talk. I thought there's something in there, the fact that I was stuck on that chapter about finding a teacher when I came to this practice. And what Jack says is, when we find a skillful teacher and a lineage, he emphasizes in this that the teacher is embedded in the lineage, and so when you come to a teacher, you're actually taking on the whole lineage, and you need to be comfortable with both. Okay? When we find a skillful teacher and a lineage we can trust and respect, this becomes a beacon to illuminate our hearts and our path. It gives us an opportunity to discover that which is genuine and timeless for ourselves and to carry that light into all the world. Questions, comments, objections? Part that I was hung up on in that book is the guru thing. You know, this idea that I had to just give, you know, check my brain at the door and just hand it all over to a teacher. And of course, once I came to this tradition, I found out you don't have to do that. In fact, you're encouraged not to do that. You know, investigation is one of the factors of enlightenment in this path. So, yes.
Your last statement just brought something to mind. Is that I was in a different group before coming to this, a Pierre Jeff Ostinsky group, and the teacher was abusing his power in many ways. And you know, I left that, and I think it delayed me getting started in anything else because it stepped in me a distrust for that kind of power.
Sure. Absolutely, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what kind of process you went through before you decided to ask that woman, first of all, or Steve, to be your teacher? Uh-huh. What kind of considerations were you thinking besides these as far as a match? And
yeah, well, first I was getting stable in my own meditation practice, and I was also in the process of undergoing the training with Dennis. So I already had him as a teacher. So I was kind of looking for a different viewpoint. And I felt like my practice, maybe because I was doing all this other stuff, was plateauing a little bit. And so I had this thing that I've always had in my life, even before I came to this practice, about blind spots. And that I kind of feel like I have some blind spots that can best be seen by other people looking at me and consulting with them. So I thought, well, maybe if I get another teacher that isn't necessarily, you know, Dennis that I'm working with virtually on a daily basis, that will help me. You know, not that Dennis wasn't really skilled, but our relationship at that point was the training for this role. That was the primary thing. And so I think it'd be better to have another teacher that can work with me on my meditation practice. So when Steve asked me what I meant by that, and I told him what I meant, I said I wanted some mentoring on my personal practice, my meditation practice, and I wanted some mentoring on my role as a mentor, he said, well, I teach on a retreat. If you want to be my student, you come to my retreats. And so that's the way I worked with him. Others, and so we meet in person when I go to this retreat. We might do a phone call every couple months or every 3 months, and that's about it. I haven't felt the need for something more ongoing than that or more frequent. Other people might. But one of the factors in working with Steve was the fact that, you know, he lived on Maui at the time, he lives in Seattle now, and it's, you know, there's that that physical distance. So willing to work with someone at a distance, that would be a consideration. The fact is that in this Sacramento area, we have very few resident senior Vipassana teachers, people that have been through the training. We don't have, correct me, please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not aware of any that live in Sacramento that have been through that three, four, five year teacher training.
No. The CDL?
There are CDL folks around. I mentioned them. All the ones I knew, I mentioned. Well, Susan Orr, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, Heather and John are the two closest senior teachers in this tradition up in Nevada City. Mm-hmm. Heather will be here next week, by the way. So, and several people from this community, as you know, are working with her in a senior students program, and that kind of thing is available. But, you know, it's going to involve some kind of distance. So that's a consideration, too, you know, financial considerations and, you know, distance and how the teacher is comfortable with working. There might be teachers that are comfortable working on Skype or FaceTime or something like that. So that's a consideration, too. The other sangha that's nearby, not quite as nearby, is Insight, a meditation center in Redwood City. And so we have, you know, Gil Fronsdal there, we have Andrea Fella that's there, and people from this community have worked with them in the past. And I know Susan Orr worked with James Barras, who's in the Bay Area. All the Spirit Rock teachers are, many of them have sanghas in the Bay Area, but that's the Bay Area.
So your process was, you had some practical considerations with Steve, but then some of it was just kind of your intuition about, like, matching with
right.
His teaching that kind of resonated with you when you...
Yeah, he'd come here for those day-longs that he does every year. Mm-hmm. So I'd been to a couple of those, mm-hmm. and then I'd been on a residential retreat with him without even thinking of mm-hmm. of having him as a teacher. I just went on this retreat. He and Kamala were both teaching. I liked them both. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I wasn't really thinking of him as being, you know, my teacher, partly because of the distance. Mm-hmm. And so I gradually worked through it, spent some time with him in the retreat settings, and then in less formal settings when he would come for his weekends here, and kind of play with that, you know, and say, well, how would the fit be? And how do I feel when I'm in his presence? And how does he answer questions when people ask them on retreat? And does that work? Does his style work for me? Does that sound like something that would be helpful for me? So, yeah. Sure.
So, how about teachers from other traditions? How about connecting with a teacher from a different tradition, but staying in the Insight tradition?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And you know, I mean, there's a lot of Zen monks around. Senior teacher of Zen monks thinking of one in particular. I mean, he would be a fantastic teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, there are.
Yeah.
I just go with Jack Kornfield on this one, where he recommends that that you embrace both the teacher and their lineage as a package. The teacher's coming out of a lineage. A good teacher comes out of a lineage. They just don't appear out of nowhere. So come out of a lineage, both in terms of their own practice and in terms of the teachers that have preceded them. Okay, so, you know, I studied with Dennis. Dennis studied with Steve Armstrong. Steve Armstrong studied with Upandita. Upandita studied with Mahasi Sayadaw Mahasi, you know, all the way back to the Buddha, right? And so when you take on a teacher, I can see the wisdom in Jack's statement that you take on that whole lineage. Now, certainly you can have a favorite Zen teacher that every time they come to Sacramento, you go hear them, you know, right? Doesn't mean necessarily that you're in this really one-to-one close. I'm talking about a one-to-one close teacher-student relationship here. That's what I'm talking. I'm not talking about getting wisdom from somebody. That person that turned me down, every chance I get to hear her, I do. I still consider her my teacher. She didn't consider me her student, but in that one-on-one sense. But I listen to her talks. You know, when she does stuff online, I try to, you know, attend it, so forth. I have books around. I read them. They're very useful. So, you know, even though we didn't enter into that close relationship, I still benefit from her teaching. You could do the same thing with someone from another tradition. But this kind of relationship of depth, when you're really taking someone on and saying,
I'm going to go wherever they can take me and really commit myself to that person. I would say if you found another teacher in another tradition, you would want to be willing to take on that tradition as well.
It sounds like there's a really high student-to-teacher ratio. Is that a problem?
Very true. It is a problem in this tradition. When you think about the two people that Kamala and Steve are teaching, training right now to become full-time, or they might need it, they might keep their day jobs, but to become teachers in this tradition, senior teachers, one of them dropped out of med school, and the other one is a PhD psychologist. And is giving that, I mean, to some extent, giving up, you know, being a university professor or whatever. You know, that amount of, and it so happens, well, it's not coincidence, but so happens both of them trained with Utejaniya in Burma, who is Steve's current teacher, and I've been on retreats with them, and Laura's going on retreat with him. So, you know, there's this whole lineage thing happening. But you think about that level of commitment, that's needed, and the financial sacrifice. Somebody becomes a senior teacher in this tradition, you know, they're not going to be Deepak Chopra, you know, raking in the big bucks, you know. Do you know? So they're committing to a life of, you know, as Steve says, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, all those people that brought the tradition to this country, Jack, were living out of their suitcases for 10 years, sleeping on people's living room floors. You know, that level of commitment is extraordinary. And I didn't have it, you know. I waited till I retired to take on this role. So it's extraordinary level of commitment. I think in this tradition, the student-to-teacher ratio will always be high. And, you know, with this whole mindfulness revolution that's going on, and mindfulness is in the press, and that's going to bring in more students, which is a really wonderful thing. It's not going to bring in any more skilled teachers, I don't think. I mean, it may, but it's not going to triple the number of fully trained, skilled, dedicated teachers that are out there. And it's certainly not going to improve the ratio. So, no, you're absolutely right. We have to be creative, which is why it's great that there's online resources and all of that. You can benefit from a teacher without necessarily being with them face-to-face every week.
But the other hand is we're so fortunate to be here so we can actually drive a couple hours and go see somebody occasionally versus like somebody you run into around the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Really.
Look at Jeff, it's like, you know, in Sedona, Arizona. You know, we think of Sedona as being, you know, a spiritual vortex. In terms of this tradition, you know, and the availability of teachers, Brian Lessage up in Flagstaff is in the teacher training program right now. That's it. There's no resident senior teachers, even in a spiritual mecca like Sedona, Arizona. Yeah, we are very, very fortunate. Very fortunate. Yes?
I'm just curious, for those of us that don't have a teacher, what goes on between, in other words, does the student sort of gather up questions and then when you talk once a month or whatever, here's what I've been wondering about, or do you just kind of talk and hash things out?
I'm not familiar with every teacher, but the way that I've worked with both Dennis and Steve, and the way that they work is very similar to what you would do on retreat. You first describe your practice. You describe what's happening in your practice. You know, how long are you sitting? How's it going? What's coming up? What, you know, and then they offer guidance based on that description. So yeah, typically you wouldn't go in with a laundry list of questions. You would be very much in the present and speaking with them in the present at that level of what's happening in your practice. You know, I mean, now certainly, you know, if you had some. You know, I mean, I went to him with the Donna question. If you had some life-shattering event happen, you know, a good teacher would be there for you in that circumstance. But day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, the way I work with Steve now is, you know, he just asked me to report on how the practice is going, and
we have a brief conversation. We'll speak maybe half an hour every 3 months or so. And, you know, I'll be going on retreat with him in early May, and we'll have the same interviews all the other students would have on whatever schedule all the other students are on. There'll be group interviews. And then he'll usually set aside an extra 10-15 minutes for me to discuss the Sangha or my mentoring role as a separate thing from the practice. So you should expect to be in the present and reporting from your own experience.
Thank